So the school year's nearly over. At last, the term's ending in a flurry of concerts and sports days. So stuff the syllabus. All the children and young people who see the week stretching ahead, this podcast is for you. In the studio with me is Julia Eccleshare, the Guardian's children's books editor. Welcome, Julia.
Hello.
Next week is the start of the summer break. Is this a moment of importance for publishers, or does it mean nothing to them?
Oh, no, it is a moment of importance, and they tend to round up their books ready for the summer and highlight certain titles. But it isn't a time for the best new publishing, because people make kind of impulse buys in the summer. The serious fiction is all published in the autumn, or almost all published in the autumn, so the big dates are September. But in the summer, there are the frothy titles that they think will grab children immediately, either on the shelf or by their title.
And so are there any big books that we should be reading? I noticed that you brought in Katie Morag, and I absolutely love Katie Morag.
Well, you can't really call Katie Morag a big book, but she's a perennial favourite, and I think she's a great holiday book because her stories are set on her island in Scotland. And they are important, I think, for us culturally, because we have very few books which actually show children growing up in the country. So they give a picture of a slice of life that's very different. But for children going on holiday, they also show what holiday might be like. One of the funniest writers I think we've had for the last 20 years is Anne Fine, and Eating Things on Sticks is her, again, it's set on a Scottish island, as it happens, but it is a hilarious story about a dismal, disastrous holiday in a very, very rainy Scottish island, and I think anybody going on holiday would enjoy that. I mean, in a way, holiday reading is different from term time reading, isn't it? Because you do want to be taken out of yourself and sent off somewhere completely different.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also got a Grook book. I'm particularly interested in that because Joshua Doda, the author, used to work for The Guardian.
Well, the Grook adventures are great. This is the ninth. And again, I mean, like with the Anne Fine, which is also for the sort of nine plus, I think that's a period where you really have to get stuck into reading. If you're not a keen reader at that point and you don't find the books that will really inspire you, you won't be reading Stephanie Meyer necessarily at 10, 11, 12. So I'm very keen on books like the Grook Adventures. I'm very keen on adventure in general. I mean, adventure's been the bedrock of children's fiction really for the last 100 years. And that, to me, is what makes stories great. Is it an exciting story? And the Grook Adventures are. It's mm-hmm. great stuff.
More of Grook in a moment, when the author himself will be joining Sarah Crown in the studio. I'll be on creche duty as his baby's coming in with him. Now, we also hope you'll be reading the fabulous books on our Guardian Children's Fiction Prize longlist. Julia, will you tell us a bit about it?
Well, the thing about the prize longlist is it's an incredibly distinguished list because it's only eight titles chosen out of the 12,000 published in the whole year. We're immensely proud of the prize, of previous winners who include Meg Rosoff, Mal Peet, Jacqueline Wilson, and going back further than that, Anne Fine herself has won it. But each year we find really a range of outstanding books, and they're not necessarily the books that have, you know, made the most money for the author. They're not necessarily the books that are piled high in the bookshelf, but they are books. This prize is judged by other children's writers. So they are books which are shown to be very well written, very powerful in what they're saying. And this year we feel we've got a very good long list.
So we've got to wait till September to learn who's on the shortlist and October to find out who's actually won. So for now, tell us about the long list.
Well, the long list starts, it's for any book for 8+, and the youngest is Linda Newberry's Lob, which is a sort of imaginary story about a child who can see a little green creature in the garden with her grandfather. That's most imaginary. But there are, you know, there is Adventures, there's Maurice Gleitzman's Now, which is the third in his trilogy about the Holocaust. There's Michelle Paver's Last in Her, wonderful ghost hunter series. There's Teresa Breslin's Prisoner of the Inquisition, a horrible story set in the time of the Spanish Inquisition, which needs to be revisited very often so children know how awful times used to be. Eva Ibbotson's witty Ogre of Oglethorpe, a sort of troll fantasy. Ali Kennan's hilarious Sparks, How You Bury Your Grandfather in a Viking Burial Against Your Parents' Wishes. And Gregory Hughes's Road Story, Unhooking the Moon, about how two children go on a journey to find a better life for themselves. And Marcus Sedgwick's quite gruesome gothic novel, The White Crow. So there's a huge range of fiction in there. We really do feel there's something for everybody, and we do encourage all children to read these books.
One gang of keen readers has already done just that. I went down to the Ellen Wilkinson School in West London to get the lowdown on the long list. Now let's go to the really important people who are actually the readers of the books. We've got a couple of you who read... Ooh, that's very impressive. That's the school bell, by the way. You wouldn't know that we were in a school without the school bell, so that's actually good. So we've got a couple of people who've read White Crow. Who's hands up who's read White Crow? You two. Ah, good. You're sitting next to each other. So tell us a little bit about what you thought of it.
Basically, there's this girl called Rebecca, and she lives in London, but then she moves to this place called Winterfold, and she meets a strange girl called Ferelith, and they become friends, and then they find all these different secrets and stories.
Had you read previous books by Marcus Sedgwick?
Yeah, I read Revolver. I think White Crow was a bit better.
That was Hannah and Samira. We've got a few ghost hunters. Who's read Ghost Hunter? Tell me who you are.
I'm Lauren, year 7.
And what did you think of it?
It's quite good. It's a gripping to finish the whole series off.
So this is the series of the Chronicles of Ancient Darkness?
Yes, they consist of 6 books. And the first one was really high up and I didn't really want to put it down, whereas the kind of the second and third kind of went down a bit and then they go up and down.
I'm Kasia, year 7. I really liked the book. It was the first time I read Moshe Pever and I think it was the best book I ever read.
You read now. Give us your name and age.
Afreen, year 9. It was a really unique story and the author has a really different style of writing. So it's from the point of view of a 8 or 10-year-old and it's really different to how other books are written. And it's a really good story.
I'm Kyla and I'm from year 8. And I was really anticipating now because I read the previous 2 books, Once and Then. So I was really looking forward to how the story would conclude. I also felt a little bit disappointed because the book moved on to the main character Felix's granddaughter instead. So it was a bit disappointing, but it was nice to see his life, you know, kind of laid out and he's happy. So that was good.
So let's go on to the last one. The last but not least at all is Sparks.
I'm Ferry and I'm in year 7. At first it didn't seem very good, like it seemed one of these childish kind of books, like the cover kind of gave that kind of interpretation as well. In the beginning it was like boring and I thought I didn't want to read this book and I felt like I had to read it. But then near the middle it got more exciting and I actually wanted to read it, like I didn't want to eat or anything, I was just reading it like straight on. But it's not the kind of book I would normally read, but I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Who's read Unhooking the Moon? You two. So what did you think of Unhooking the Moon?
I thought it was really good. I mean, when I first looked at the book, the cover didn't look that interesting, so I thought it was going to be kind of a bit of a lame fantasy again.
Let's describe the cover. What do you think of the cover?
It looks really strange.
It's got bicycles going around the moon, hasn't it?
Yeah, it looks a bit childish and not for teenagers and stuff.
I like White Crow by Marcus Sedgwick because it looks kind of mysterious and like you want to read it because it looks effective as well, like with the black and the birds and the person looking kind of hopeless.
Well, we're all told never to judge a book by its cover, but clearly, like it or loathe it, the cover does count for a lot, doesn't it, Julia? Does it count for more with children's books and young people's books than for adults, do you think?
Well, I think it does because they give a book a very quick look and the cover is the first thing that will grab them. They all say that they only read the first page and if that hasn't grabbed them, you know, so the cover's got to get you there in the first place. And publishers know that. And indeed, you know, at the moment, the big thing is an author being a brand and that brand comes from having a good, strong cover design. So if you think of Jacqueline Wilson, she was made into a brand by being teamed up with Nick Sharratt. And ever since that, you know, we've got Artemis Fowl, we've got big series like the new Rick Riordan series of the Percy Jackson books. We've got the Robert Muchamore books. We've got loads of series with very strong cover identity.
Sometimes it's about having the author's name in a very recognisable typeface and very big on all the
very
books,
big and often in foil. I mean, shiny is good and publishers know that those big, bright, shiny covers attract readers. And I think it's very impressive that The White Crow, which isn't a hugely expensive cover, has managed to reach out to the readers so strongly.
Mm-hmm. It's also about reaching out to a certain age group, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, you know, children are very unkeen to read books that they think are too young for them. So publishers have to be quite subtle about this because they want to show parents and children themselves that the book is for younger readers, but they don't in any way want to make it look babyish. So on the whole, the covers for sort of nine plus readers are quite stylized rather than showing young children because they don't want to actually alienate older readers from them.
I knew that he loved Gordon.
Yeah.
Well, back at the school, I gathered together a group of girls from the book club of all different ages and asked them what they thought. Do you have a sense of books that are aimed for younger children and books that are aimed for people older than you?
Well, I read the blurb as well to check what the book's about, and
if it's suitable for your age or not.
I wouldn't read a younger kind of book. I would read a quick read, like just fun, but not like for a proper read. And I would read older books if like my parents said they're appropriate and all that. And I think that's good, like, because you get a wider range.
So I read like the first chapter and I actually got really into it. Just carried on reading. And it's definitely much better on the inside.
I tend to pick up a book like that kind of grabs me with the title. And then from there, I'll read the first few pages to see if that grips me. But if it doesn't, I may sit down and just say, right, I'll try again, like with another book.
And of course, it's not just the age group that's signalled by the cover, it's gender too. I asked the Ellen Wilkinson girls how they felt about the division between girls' and boys' books.
I don't think there's such thing as a girls' book or a boys' book, because I mean, anyone can read what they enjoy. So, to be honest, I read all these, like, army books and war books, to be honest, or my dad's old ones.
I think you kind of can say this is a boys' book and girls' book. Some books you can't. It might be right for a boy, but a girl can read it too. But some books you wouldn't expect... most boys wouldn't read it. Some might, like... You wouldn't see most boys reading, like, the Twilight books or any other books, but books like Harry Potter or something, both girls and boys would enjoy it because it's good enough.
I don't think you should just say, OK, this is a boys' book, that's a girls' book, because, I mean, my parents read all these books and I, like, picked up this book called My Father's Rifle or something, and some people might say it was a boys' book, but I started it and I'm still reading it and it's really good, like... I don't think you should say that's a girl's book, that's a boy's book. I think that person should just decide for themselves.
Julia, I suspect if it was a group of boys we'd been talking to, the answer might have been rather different. They wouldn't read anything that they thought was too sort of girly, would they?
Well, no, and the difficulty for publishers is they've taken this line that there are a lot of books that they've given pink covers to, and that really precludes boy readers from reading them. But, you know, we have to remember there's a huge chunk in the middle of fiction which is for both sexes, and, you know, though we tend to think of humour books like the Mr. Gum books or Philip R. Dar's Grubtown Tales, we tend to think of them as boys' things. Girls love humour too. They all love Lemony Snicket. Vampires are read more by the girls, but boys are reading the vampire stories as well. They need to know what the competition is, I think. and then, of course, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the kind of key crossover bit is the historical fiction, which, you know, is often quite good for girls, but boys can read too. So, yes, I mean, I think boys are not going to read pink-covered books, but I think that we mustn't think that all fiction has been shifted into two opposing camps. That would be a great shame.
Mm-hmm. And one of the girls there mentioned My Father's Rifle, A Childhood in Kurdistan by Haina Salim, I hope I pronounced that right, published in 2004, which seems to be a novelised memoir of life as a Kurd, the problems of life. Memoir is a very big area, isn't it? And that's presumably, it can be read by both boys and girls.
Yeah, I mean, memoir in adult and children's fiction is huge, and particularly childhood memoirs, as we can see from the huge success of Misery memoirs. But if you take a book like The Diary of Anne Frank, it's going strong, and despite its girl title, it's read by boys and girls, I think, with equal delight.
As I promised earlier in the programme, we have the children's author Joshua Doder, also known as Josh Lacey, coming up. That's to say, we at The Guardian know him as Josh Lacey, and he writes some of his children's books under that name, but it's as Joshua Doder that he's penned the hugely successful Grook series. In any case, whilst I was literally left holding the baby, Sarah Crown whisked him into the studio to find out about the next instalment of Grook's adventures.
Hi Josh, thanks very much for coming in. We're here to talk about the seventh book in your series, and the series is called Grook. First of all, am I saying it right? And secondly, can you explain a bit about what these books are about?
I pronounce him Grook.
Grook.
But you can pronounce him however you like. And
thank you.
Some people say Grook or Gurk, or quite a lot of people call him GRK, which I've never really understood. But anyway, I say Grook. And the series is about a small black and white dog called Grook, who in the first book, which is A Dog Called Grook, he is discovered wandering through the streets of London by a boy named Tim. And basically, at the end of the first book, Tim and Grook end up living together. And then in a series of other books, they have all kinds of adventures around the world in different countries.
They're very traditional books, really, aren't they? And I was trying to describe them to somebody earlier on today and came up with the idea that they were sort of the Prisoner of Zenda via the Famous Five. So sort of spies and swashbuckling and adventures and, you know, taking you to all these different places. As he said, they go to Brazil and the Seychelles and New York. They're very well travelled, these children. Was that what you were going for, this sort of traditional adventure story?
I mean, I don't think I was going for anything. It just sort of came out that way. But certainly when I wrote the first one, I was thinking about The Prisoner of Zenda. Yes.
Yeah.
I love that book. And The Wind on the Moon. That was written in the 40s, I think.
Who's another that
very
by?
Eric Linklater. Very traditional, but completely wonderful children's book. And then The Silver Sword. Do you know that? Ian
yes.
Sorelia, which is one of my favourite books. So I suppose I was thinking about the books that I really passionately loved when I was 8 or 10 or that kind of age. And I don't think I made a deliberate effort to write like that. I just wanted to write the kind of book that I'd really have wanted to read. And so that's what came out.
And now you're going to read to us from the seventh book. And what's the title of this book?
Well, each is set in a different country, and you can guess where this one's set because it's called Grook Down Under. And I'm going to read just a little bit from near the beginning of the book, which is where Tim and his parents have gone to a wedding in Italy, and they've had to leave Grook behind in a kennels. And I don't know if you've ever been to a dog kennel, but it's not the nicest of places. This is called Cuddles Kennels. And I'm going to read a bit from this. Grook was ready. It was breakfast time. He could hear footsteps. Grook lay down on the floor and placed his head on his paws. Twice a day, Trevor Cuddle came down the corridor with a pair of buckets. He stopped at every cell, delivering food and water to the dogs. Once a day, Marjorie Cuddle, Trevor's wife, or their daughter Jean, took the dogs for a walk. Grook could hear shrieks and howls of anticipation. Up and down the corridor, other dogs were scratching the bars of their cages, wild with excitement, desperate to get their teeth clamped around some biscuits. He listened to the footsteps and the yowls and the barking and the jangling keys and the rattling biscuits. These sounds were repeated again and again. Then he saw Trevor Cuddle stopping outside his cell. As always, Trevor was wearing big black boots, dirty jeans, an old blue shirt and thick rubber gloves. He was carrying a bucket of water in his left hand and a bucket of dog biscuits in his right hand. "Morning, Grook," said Trevor. "How are you today?" Without waiting for an answer, Trevor put the buckets on the floor, reached down to his leather belt and unclipped a large ring of keys, one for each cage in the kennels. He sorted through the ring, searching for number 73. Trevor turned the key in the lock, clipped the ring back on his belt, picked up his buckets and stepped into the cage. "Breakfast time," he said. "I hope you're hot." A white flash sped between his big black boots. "What?" cried Trevor Cuddle. But he was talking to himself. Grook was already sprinting down the corridor, past barred doors and locked cages, ignoring the shouts and barks and squeals that pursued him. Trevor shouted at the top of his voice, "Hey, Grook, come back here right now." Grook took no notice. He turned the corner and disappeared from sight. Trevor Cuddle reached down to his belt and grabbed his walkie-talkie. He brought it up to his mouth. "Escape in progress," he yelled. "Culprit is proceeding along corridor 3 and heading for the north door. Escape, escape. I repeat, we have an escape." Grook sped down the corridor. On either side of him, dogs darted forwards, hurling themselves at the bars of their cages. Bloodhounds, beagles, borzois, schnauzers, spaniels, salukis, collies, corgis and chihuahuas. They all wanted to join him. Their yelps and cries urged him onwards, willing him to outwit the Cuddles. Grook would have liked to stop and say hello to every dog he passed, but there wasn't time for chit-chat. He just had to run. He didn't know where to go, of course, nor did he know what he would do when he got there. He didn't have a car. He couldn't catch a bus or a train. Maps meant nothing to him. The route from Cuddle's kennels to his own comfy basket was long and complicated. Even if he managed to get out of the kennels, there was very little chance that he would ever be able to find his way back home. Grook didn't worry about any of that. He just ran.
And we'll have to read the book to find out where he got to.
Yes. Or guess from the title.
Yes, I suppose I could probably come up with a guess. Now, it's a truism of acting that you should never work with animals. Obviously, that isn't true for you as a writer.
I don't quite know how to answer that, since that phrase is never work with children or animals. So I yes. don't think that quite applies to people who
writer.
Write children's books. I love writing about Grook because, well, I suppose perhaps he's some sort of piece of me deep inside me which likes breaking laws and doing the wrong thing and getting everything wrong and turning everything upside down, because that's what he does. He's a dog who doesn't really see the point of rules and regulations.
So do you think that's why he's so good for this 8 to 12 market, which is a notoriously difficult market for people to write for, but that thing of rule breaking and turning everything upside down, do you think that's why he appeals to people of that age?
I don't know. I mean, the boy in the story, Tim, is not like that. He's more like me, I think. He's quite sensible. You know, he doesn't want to sort of annoy his parents or do the wrong thing. And so I think they're an interesting combination, Tim and Grook. There's a sort of boy who wants to do the right thing and a dog who doesn't care at all about the difference between right and wrong.
We heard from the passage that you read that these books are pretty rich in humour. There are a lot of jokes, and there are jokes for the adults who are reading as well. Is it difficult when you're writing for children of this sort of age to pitch the book in such a way that their parents are going to want to read it with them?
I don't aim it at the parents at all. I mean, I suppose I'm writing a book that I want to read, and it's the part of me that is still 8 years old, and it's the part of me which is however fantastically aged I am now. So, you know, I want to write jokes that will appeal to both sides of me. I don't think Grook is a sort of crossover book like Harry Potter or something. You're not going to see grown-ups reading it on the tube when they're commuting home from work, no.
The age factor is one thing, but the other thing that people talk about a lot when they're talking about children's books is gender, and particularly the fact that it's difficult to find books for boys. And I've seen the Grook series recommended on lots of parenting websites when people ask, you know, what can I give my 9-year-old son to read? Time and again, the name of these books comes up. And did you conceive of them as books for boys, or is it just a happy coincidence?
I certainly didn't conceive of them like that. I suppose I'm a boy. I was a boy. There is a girl in them as well, and I hope girls will enjoy reading them. Yeah, I'm delighted if boys like reading them.
And we've talked about the idea of children reading for pleasure. It's the summer holidays. It's time to put away all your school books and pick up the books that you really want to read. And certainly the Grook books fall into this category. You've mentioned a couple of books that you used to love reading when you were younger, but in the course of your new life as a children's author, which are the other books that you'd really recommend for this age group?
Holes is a very well-known book, but it's absolutely brilliant. And if anyone hasn't read Holes, then they should. What else?
And that's by?
Louis Sachar. And there's a lovely book called Freak the Mighty. I can't remember who it's by. But anyway, that's another one that you could look up.
Yes,
and
we'll look
really
it up
great.
For you. Yeah. We'll put a list of these up on the website. And then just final question. Why the name Grook? It's so hard to pronounce. You must have a reason for it.
Why the name Grook? In fact, my publisher occasionally puts his head in his hands and says, how could you choose a name that no one can pronounce? Normally, when people ask me how I chose the name Grook, I show them exactly how I chose it. What I would have here is a bottle of wine. I was on holiday in Croatia several years ago, and I went to probably the most beautiful place I've ever been, which is an island in Croatia called Korčula. And there I had a wine which is only produced on Korčula, which is called Grook. And I remembered this name. And a few years later, I was writing a book about a dog from a small Eastern European country. And a boy finds this dog in the street and looks on his collar, and the collar says, my name is... And I thought, what is this dog's name? And then I remembered this wine, Grook, and I thought, okay, that's a nice name. I'm going to steal that name. And that's where Grook comes from.
Thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it from us on this week's Books podcast. We'll be back next week with our take on the book A Long List, which will be announced on Tuesday. Meanwhile, in the Guardian's Saturday Review this weekend, learn about the seductions of technology across the centuries from Tom McCarthy, who incidentally is widely tipped to be on that book A List next week. The Observer's new review, meanwhile, will be posing the theory that television book clubs are actually much more influential than prizes anyway. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Lucy Greenwell.